And it's my pleasure to welcome to the Crow Symposium our next speaker. Harley Eagle is of Dakota Indigenous descent, enrolled in the Whitecap Dakota First Nations Reserve in Saskatchewan, Canada. He currently lives in Winnipeg, Manitoba, with his wife and two daughters. He is the coordinator for Indigenous work for the Mennonite Central Committee of Canada. Along with this work, he is a member or consultant of Indigenous Issues Forums, a team of folks dedicated to creating safe and respectful family-centered environments to talk through challenging issues. Further to this, they co-design and co-facilitate restorative justice workshops, their work to recall and reclaim Indigenous understandings and life ways that allow people to walk in balance today and for future generations. He is also a dismantling racism trainer facilitator and is often asked to bring this understanding to the work and presentations he does. Harley is often invited to present nationally and internationally at various conferences and organizations about issues pertaining to his work. Please join me in welcoming Harley Eagle to the podium.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's certainly good to be here. And once again, my name is Harley Eagle. And as it was mentioned, I'm of Dakota descent on my father's side and Anishinaabe on my mother's side, both Indigenous folks of this part of the world. Oftentimes, we call it Turtle Island, this North America. And that's more in reference to remembering some of our creation stories, and also to put a different slant to help people remember that this land has been inhabited for thousands and thousands of years by what I would call folks that were full of genius and brilliance, and we're still around to this day. I wanted to acknowledge and give gratitude for being invited to this wonderful event. I've been so impressed with all of the speakers and found connections to everything that folks have been saying. So it's been really wonderful, eye-opening for myself and affirming, because I'm seeing very similar patterns in the work that's being described to me, and finding that there's so much that's in common with the work that I do and the processes and encounters that we as Indigenous people of this land have been facing for many, many years. I want to especially thank Tim Barr, who is one of the main organizers of this event. And I say that because Tim is somebody over the years that I've gotten to know that holds himself accountable to people like me. He strives very hard to understand racism, the racialization of people like me, and of himself. And he finds a way of trying to be accountable to those dynamics and trying to be ever curious about what does this mean and how do I affect change and how do I embrace this uncomfortable subject. So I want to thank Tim for inviting me here and for the work that we've done over the years together, and I look forward to the continued relationship building that we've been doing. I also want to take the time to acknowledge this land beyond the life of this university. The lands where people have lived for thousands and thousands of years beneath this building. The people that I'm aware of, and I'm sure I don't know all of the folks that lived here and that would cross this land and use this land and be in relationship with this land, but those that I have heard about are the Bedai people, the Karen Kawa, the Caddo, and the Comanche. And as colonization happened in this part of the world, there were folks that were forced to move here, pushed onto this part of the world. And some of those nations are the Alabama, the Cherokee, and the Kickapoo. I want to ask the question, is there anybody in this room that identifies as Indigenous? If you just quickly raise your hand. Are there folks here that identify as Indigenous? Thank you. I see some hands. Thank you very much. It's always helpful for me to know this because I speak about things and I want to acknowledge that I come from my understanding of things. I come from Dakota, Anishinaabe, and other kinds of perspectives. But I know that I don't have the only perspective. And I want to respect those people that perhaps are from this area that have a different way of describing what has happened here and their experiences and situations. So I want to acknowledge that I'm a visitor here on this land. And so if you carry, if you're a descendant of those nations that I named, thank you for allowing me to be on your land. I also want to acknowledge the elders in the room, those folks who have many years of experience, who have wisdom based on their experiences. And it's very important for us as younger folks to look to our elders and to honor our elders, no matter what your background is. And sometimes that's hard, you know. Sometimes it's hard. You know, a friend of mine from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, he said to me one time, you know, one of our biggest challenges as younger Indigenous people is the relationship with our elders. Because a lot of times they've been so impacted by colonization, it has changed their thinking. And we're trying to undo a lot of these things. And some of our elders have taken on traditions that are not healthy and not helpful to the growth of who we are as human beings. But I also know that there's many fantastic elders and folks that encourage us and push us and impart wisdom to us that help us along our path. So I think it's very important in this fast-paced society where oftentimes we segregate our elders and we diminish their importance in our lives. I think it's very important that we reinvigorate embracing the elders within our midst. I also want to specifically acknowledge the women in the room. For many Indigenous groups, many of them were matriarchal. Some were egalitarian. But certainly from my experiences, most would talk about the importance of taking direction from women, and that women were actually the leaders of our nations. In my setting, in my Dakota culture, women were the ones that put men into leadership positions based on their skill, based on the things that they knew and the specific ways that they had of dealing with various situations, and would select a leader that was appropriate for the time. And when that time had ended, they would pull that leader back and put somebody else in. And also, if that leader, that man, began to misbehave himself because of perhaps the power that he was given, they could also pull him back, and it was their right to do that. And also with with home ownership, if you will, our lodges were considered women's. This was the women's place. And that we as men, we as partners, were guests there. And they had the right, if we were, once again, being inappropriate, they had the right to put our belongings outside of the teepee, and folks would know that there's a problem that you have, sir, and you need to change. And so it was a way of actually kind of publicly shaming a man to get it back into line and to remember that he has roles and responsibilities and a way of interacting with women that's so important to remember. And lastly, I want to thank the singers that sang just after lunch. I'm a flute player, and I tend to, more and more in more recent years, I use the flute when I talk with groups or when I'm leading a session or doing some work within a circle. And the flute, the Native American flute, there's many stories of how it came into being, and it's an ancient instrument, and many cultures from all over the world have used this wind instrument. But from my teachings, the flute was originally an instrument given to women, and women in turn gave it to men to help us men to remember, to honor, to cherish women, and to always respect them. And so I find it's very important for myself as a man to embrace this instrument so that it helps me to honor my partner and my children and my relatives and my friends who are women, that provide direction in my life. So I also want to thank the singers for me, that's what it felt like. It felt like a beautiful flute song with the harmonies and the blending of tones and rhythms, and specifically that it was all women that were doing that. It was very meaningful for me, so I really want to thank you. It was a tremendous reminder for me. Further to that, it's important to incorporate music and creativity, dance, what have you, in all of the work that we do. In settings like this, and I actually don't really prefer to present like this, because we end up using usually one side of our brain. But when we incorporate movement and music and creativity and art into the way we do things, it helps to stimulate both sides of the brain. And so it gives us a fuller understanding, and it helps us to embrace what we're hearing in different ways, in ways that are more helpful to not just our brain and our logical thinking, but also to our spirit. So thank you for reminding me of the importance of that. So as I mentioned, I prefer interacting, I prefer conversations, I prefer dialogue, and I think really what I really prefer is in the circle setting, when we can have a talking circle and everybody gets a chance to share their genius and brilliance with the entire group. I much prefer that. So today, I'm not going to ask you to get into a big circle, but I'm going to make sure that I specifically leave plenty of time for you folks to come up, make comments, and ask questions. And I'm sorry that we're talking in this way of you down there and me up here. That also doesn't feel so comfortable to me. But I want to make sure that you have that opportunity. So what do I do? I'm, as was mentioned, I do a lot of what they call restorative justice work. And some folks, and including myself, have often struggled with that term, restorative justice. My friend Conrad Moore, who's an African-American fellow from Philadelphia, we'll talk about restoration to what? You know, the society is, as we've been hearing, is so stacked against us. Is this what we're trying to restore people back to? And from my own experiences of working on Pine Ridge Reservation for almost 7 years and working on this issue of conflict resolution and indigenous ways of understanding conflict and dealing with it, I had to deal with that too. Pine Ridge Reservation, for those of you that know about it, is a place that has very high unemployment, anywhere from 75 to 80% unemployment, lots of substance abuse, lots of violence going on in the community. The community is always struggling against continued treaty violations, and just the whole Indian policy of the federal and state government is a challenge for anybody to try to live with. All these different layers of bureaucracy that they have to live with, and the legacy of colonization and genocide in their lives that still impact them to this day, that's what they live with every day. And so I had to ask myself that question as I was being asked to do this work around restorative justice. Restore them to what? Restore them to the situation that's in their communities? How do I embrace this and think about this in ways that will be helpful, that will provide hope for people? So I do restorative justice work, and I'll get back to that a little bit later about the concept of restorative justice. I also do dismantling racism work. And that has to do, for me, of why I really feel that's important, is something that I want to really encourage in you folks, and I would guess that you're already doing this, is to be very analytical in your thinking, to think critically. And I don't mean to be criticizing all the time, telling your friends I don't like what you're wearing, you know, that kind of stuff. I want us to be able to think very critically, you know, looking at all the pieces. Just before I came here yesterday, I was up at Texas A&M University, where I was asked by a student group to give a presentation in the evening. And this group is called Aggies for Palestine. And they named my topic, they named my speech, An Eagle's Eye View of Palestine. And I didn't ask them to name it that. That's what the name they gave it. And I've been to the Middle East several times and continue to have relationships with Palestinians and others from that area in looking at that whole issue and comparing it to the colonization of this part of the world and looking at the similarities and how we can address that and also the similarities in conflict resolution from an ancient society from there and from ancient societies from here and seeing it, the similarities. But I liked it because it reminded me of what an eagle does best. It flies. It flies and it looks and it watches for prey, you know, and opportunity. But I really think that that's what critical thinking is. It's being able to transcend above the situation and to figure out what are the dynamics that are going on here, looking for patterns that uphold the injustices that we see. And that's how I think about critical thinking, to rise above and to take that look down and see how everything is put together. I believe very strongly in that, and some people call that systems theory, systems thinking, and that's something else that I've embraced in latter years or in more recent years. But it goes back to who I am as an Indigenous person, because we had that concept within our language, within our culture. And we called it Mitakoye Oyasin. And if you ever have the opportunity to pray with Indigenous people from Lakota or Dakota people in specific, at the end of their prayer, they'll often say Mitakoye Oyasin. It's kind of like the Amen of ending a prayer. It's translated more popularly as all my relations. But if you really break down that word, and you should also know about most Indigenous languages and other languages besides English, they're very conceptual languages. They paint a moving picture, if you will. And there's dynamics to it that give it life. So a phrase can mean so much. So Mitakoye Oyasin doesn't just mean all my relations. If you translate it, if you break the word down, it roughly means I am on a journey to where I belong. And so to me that speaks of movement, that speaks of growing awareness, of understanding how we are all connected. And I think Michelle Alexander said it so well last night when she talked about that awareness in her own life, that she wasn't aware of some of these things until it kind of, she was forced to figure this out and have this awakening. And I think that's what life is about. How you get to be a wise elder is by having these experiences and of walking this journey, of figuring out these dynamics, these patterns that are around us, and incorporating them into our lives and then imparting that wisdom. So systems thinking is that. It's understanding how all things are related and how they function. What are those dynamics? So I believe very, very specifically in systems thinking, and I try to incorporate it as best I can. So, and I also encourage you folks to embrace that, and I encourage the professors and instructors here to impart that onto the students here, the ability, the skill to think critically. In looking at the dynamics of racism in my life and the dynamics of colonization, my wife is of Russian-German descent, a Mennonite woman, so she identifies as a white person. And because we've been working on this issue of racism for so many years before the birth of our daughters, we decided that, you know, I'm not sure if you folks are aware of this era in U.S. and Canadian history and actually in other parts of the world too, Australia, and New Zealand, just to name a couple more, the boarding school era or the residential school era. And I forget what they call it in Australia, but it was the forced removal of children from native communities, Indigenous communities, and sending them to boarding schools or residential schools for many, many years. Oftentimes when they were 5 years old, that's when they would be whisked away. And oftentimes it was against the law. Again, there was a whole system, a structure in place that made it the law of the land that this had to happen. And if you went against it as parents and community, you would be severely punished. You would be sent to prison. This wasn't just a little blip on the screen. This went on for over 100 years. The last residential school in Canada closed in 1996. Many of my friends went. My parents were sent. I didn't go, but my parents did. So we live with that legacy in our lives. It was a way of changing a worldview of a people. The motto that was developed here in the U.S. for that era was to kill the Indian but save the man. And sadly, one of the things that we as church organizations and Christian denominations have to face is that the government and churches partnered in that process. We've been hearing about facing these difficult past and trying to understand some of these things. A lot of times, looking in the mirror means facing a lot of very difficult, very challenging history and current ways of being. But we must find that courage to be able to face these things. So with that, knowing that in my life, and I also want to acknowledge, too, my wife would tell you that she realized that there were unhealthy dynamics in her schooling experience, too, as a young person, where she was driven to succeed. You know, a very stressful situation for a small child to always have to be the best in the class because her sisters were always the best, so she had to live up to that. And it was expected of her because she was a Clausen, and she needed to perform at the top of the class, and so she did, but it was very stressful. And the demands of the family, you know, to embrace that image and to live up to that image, was she recognizes how damaging that was to her to her spirit. So we decided as young parents that we would homeschool our children because I couldn't reason in my mind to give that responsibility of raising my children, of educating my children off to somebody else, to another system that I knew would not tell of my history as a Dakota person. I knew that because I didn't learn that in school. I didn't learn about myself at all. In fact, it made me learn other things that perhaps weren't relevant to who I am. It didn't teach me my language. It didn't teach me about the relationship and kinship ways that we had as people. It didn't teach me about being a part of the land, of being in relationship with the land, and you know, those kinds of very, very important things. It did not teach me that. So we decided that we would homeschool our children, and we continue to do that to this day. And there's two things that I wanted to say about that. I could talk for a long time about that whole process, but there's two things that are really important that I've found in that experience, is that we've taught our children how to be critical thinkers. They think for themselves, and they will gladly tell me and my partner when they feel that their rights, their feelings around an issue are contrary to being helpful to them. And they'll say why. They'll tell us why they feel that way. They're very good at critical thinking. And the second thing is, and maybe some of you folks might appreciate this, the second thing that I've really enjoyed about and found beautiful about homeschooling is that our children wake gently every morning. They wake when their body tells them it's time to wake up. And there's no alarm sounding off in their head. There's no mad scramble for the bus for school or to run to school or to make your lunches. There's no that stress that's in the home when that hour in the morning when you're trying to scramble to get to school. And we try very hard to wake them in gentle ways too. Sometimes I'll play my flute in the morning, and we'll make sure that we raise them gently when it's time for them to wake up. And the amazing thing is, if we tell them the night before we have to get up early to go to a meeting or to go somewhere, they'll say okay, and they get up. They're up and around and ready to go. You know, there's no, as long as they can think about it critically and think, okay, well, this is what I need to do to get ready. I have no issue with that. I'll do it. It's important to our family, so I'll do it. I wanted to say too that we've been talking a lot about racism, and it's a very uncomfortable issue. You know, folks, I do trainings all the time. I've been doing training since 1999, And this past February was the first time that we did a training where we had a really interesting problem. Never happened to us before as a training group. We had too many participants. That's the first time. Usually we would be scrambling for participants, or we would have a smaller group than what we expected. But for the first time, after all these years of doing probably hundreds of trainings, that we had too many participants. And that was a wonderful sign to us that something is happening. People are saying, okay, I'm going to embrace this subject. I'm going to look at this and try to figure out what it is. So we've been doing this for a long time. And then the aspect that my wife and I are, she's racialized white, and I'm racialized as a Native person. We've had to face this because it's been an issue in our relationship. We had to say, okay, well, this is an issue. Let's try to work with it. Let's try to figure out what are these dynamics. What has it created in us that's affecting us, who we are as a couple, who want to be in relationship with one another. And we've done that in such a way that we don't do that off by ourselves. We do it in the home. And our daughters have grown up listening to us, talking about our issues with it, our issues with our organization. You know, all kinds of times and opportunities we'll always talk about it. And they say, how do you raise a child to be racist? By not talking about race. And I've seen that in my family, in my girls. We've talked about it, and not just race, other isms too. Sexism is huge. It's something that we talk about all the time also. And the amazing thing is, there was a point several years ago, my oldest daughter's 13 now, when she was, I think, about 8. We always kept the Disney movie Pocahontas. We kept her from seeing it because we felt that it was quite stereotypical. It just builds on stereotypes, and it wouldn't be helpful for her to watch it. But she wanted to watch it, and we kind of said no for a year or so. And finally, she said to us, you know, critical thinking. She said, "How will I know that it's racist if you don't let me see it? How will I know what you're talking about if you don't let me see it?" And so we did. We let her see it, and she agreed with us. But it's that kind of thinking, it's that kind of critical thinking that I found so important to this work. The work that we've been hearing about from the speakers, that's critical thinking. That's the research that they've been doing and thinking very critically about these issues and putting it all together for people to read. And that's what we all need to do that. We all need to have those patterns established in our lives. So, the process of restorative justice, and as I mentioned before, having a little bit of difficulty over the years with that name, but I've come to a way of understanding restorative justice. I'm okay with that term now because I really feel that it is a process of restoration. It's a process, and some people call it transformative justice, and I also agree with that too. In my journey, you know, oftentimes people will ask me, you know, would it be helpful if we put Indigenous people into places of power? Would it be, you know, maybe we should, since you folks were the original citizens of this part of the world, maybe you should all be up in those seats of power and conducting legislation and governance of this land. And I say to them that to me is revolution. That's revolutionary, and that's not what I espouse to, is not revolution. I don't want to simply replace that which, you know, replace people in the structure that's already there. I want transformation. And further to that, for myself as an Indigenous people who knows of a way of life that had a way of governance that's totally different from what you see in mainstream, that worked for thousands and thousands of years, that was based on the leadership of women, that was based on the leadership of family, of extended family. And in fact, in Dakota way of life, the extended family was the centerpiece of the governance. So that was when you thought of governance of the nation. It wasn't a few people, you know, making governance up at the top somewhere in a capital. It was the extended family. And they came together as a nation once a year to talk about nation issues. But the main focus was extended family and leadership of women and elders. So I feel that we need to restore some of those ways of thinking. And it's not just the indigenous people of this land. I asked that question about being indigenous for another reason too. I bet you, or I imagine some of you, felt like maybe you could put up your hand, but didn't really know if you should. Maybe you do have some ancestry too and thought, maybe I should put up my hand, but no, I shouldn't. Because that's the complexity of this whole issue. It's a question that's not easily answered. Many of our what we're talking about here are questions that are not easily answered. They're highly complex, and that's why we need to embrace a system's way of thinking about these things, of understanding how everything is connected and put together. So, and the word indigenous in and of itself is a political word. It was created it started to be used in more popularity in the 70s and 80s with as indigenous nations from all over the world were going to the UN and saying, we don't have a space at the UN. We've been nations for thousands of years. We've interacted with colonial governments for a lot of years and colonial states, but yet we've never been acknowledged as nation states. And it's only been in the last 11 years that indigenous people have a space at the UN. And so at one point they had to decide, you know, with all of these different languages and all of these different understandings and words for who we are as a people, what are we going to use? And they came up with the word indigenous, that they felt that would work. And indigenous means of the land. It's of the land. So that's acknowledging that there is a relationship with the land. That's what specifies you as indigenous. But it takes a while to try to understand those kinds of things, thus the complexity of the issue. So I wanted to focus on one thing here as I come towards the end. And it was something that Michelle said on the first night. She talked about the values. You know, well, maybe I'll back up 1 minute and just say, in the work that I do with dismantling racism, and now I use a metaphor that I borrowed from that process. It helps me to understand other things too. It's the metaphor of an iceberg. And you know, 10% of an iceberg is what you see above the water. So 90% is underneath the water. So if all you understand about a subject like race or racism is what you see in the mainstream, you know, of race hate crimes and police brutality against people of color, those kinds of things that you see on TV and in movies, those understandings that are continually perpetuated. If that's all you know, if that's all you think racism is, then all of your energy and all of your resources are going to be focused on just that top layer, just the top 10%. And I think that's what we keep seeing with all of the way that racism and other isms continue to morph and change into something else, even though there might be people that say, well, we have to do something about this disparity. But if that's all you know, then all of your ways of dealing with it are going to be focused just on that, with that understanding. And so it's very important to go underneath the water and look at the structures that support racism. And then even further to that, to look at the identity of we as individuals that support these structures, that support the outcome of race, the difficulties of racism. And it's a crazy notion too, because it's been proven over and over again, and we talk about this a lot in racism awareness training, is that race is a myth. Race is a myth. But racism is real. So it's built on this crazy notion that some people back in the 1700s decided that they needed a way of being able to say that it's okay to hurt that group of people. It's okay for us to say that we are superior to them, they're inferior, therefore we are better than them, therefore they can be our servants, our slaves, that kind of thing. We can take their land. And once again, going back to church, the church was a part of that. I'm not sure if you've done any looking into this thing called the doctrine of discovery. But it was the way that the moral authority was given to the process of colonization. And it actually worked towards legalizing colonization in the 1400s and for a few decades after that. It was a way of legalizing. It was a way of giving value to that understanding. And that's why it's so important to go right down to the bottom and figure out, well, what are our values? Are they what we hope to be? Are they based on those wonderful values of humility and integrity and respect and generosity and compassion and courage and fortitude that we often hear about are very essential to who we want to be as human beings? Or are they about something else? And so we have to take that very difficult look at ourselves in that mirror and figure out what are the really true values of this society. And I think we won't like what we see, but we must take that look. We must find the courage to be able to go underneath that cold, cold water and look underneath and see what's down there and start addressing the issues from that understanding. So getting back to restorative justice. For me, in the years that I've been working on this, movement and on this issue, it's about restoration of those values that I named, those seven values that I named. And the first one that I named was humility. And it kind of goes back to me to the word indigenous of the earth. If you look at that word, humility, humus, it's talking about the earth. And in my teachings, the Dakota teachings, when you talk about that value, it's saying have humility like the earth. Because the earth functions in a way that it's dependent on all aspects of life that it holds. It works in mutuality, and it works on a certain cycle that allows it to continue. And it doesn't try to have one species dominate everything. It works in conjunction with other things. That's what gives us life. That diversity, that natural diversity, is what gives it life. And so I like that Indigenous goes back to that understanding of humility and of being like the earth. And I believe that that's the first relationship that's broken in this fast-paced society. It's been broken, I think, for a long time, is that understanding that we are a part of the earth and that it's a part of us. And that we shouldn't feel that we are above it and that can control it and use it up and damage it and not have any consequences. So that's, to me, is what restorative justice is. It's about restoring those values in us as human beings. And those values lead to somewhere for me, from my understanding. I believe that all of these issues that we've been talking about, the systemic terrible things that are happening that we've been illustrating here for the last, yesterday evening, or all week actually, do something that's I think sometimes that we don't talk too much about. I think that it damages our spirits. I think that when we go through these traumatic experiences, and I think we can define traumatic experiences in different ways. I talked earlier about waking our children gently. My wife will talk about how traumatic it was for her, how she was awakened quite rudely every morning, and how damaging that was to herself as a little girl, and she still feels that to this day. And that's what trauma does if it goes unresolved. It keeps you trapped in that moment. For those of you that have done study on traumatic experiences, traumatic experiences get trapped in one part of your brain that have you actually feeling and seeing in images that which you experience. That when you get triggered, you kind of go back to that first initial traumatic time, and you start feeling exactly what you felt back then. So you're reliving it. So there has to be a process of not just coping with these things, not figuring out a way of just you know, dealing with it, but actually healing from it. And to me, that's why it's important to incorporate both sides of the brain. So I appreciated the singing, and that's why I appreciate the flute. It helps us. We need to figure out a way of incorporating both sides of the brain when we're dealing with traumatic issues, to go through appropriate grieving and, you know, all of those things. And I believe that restorative justice is helpful in that, because it uses processes that are more human, which can also be connected to humility, which can also be connected to Indigenous, of actually being human So I really feel that all of these things damage our spirits, and we have to find a way of restoring our spirits. And that's where we're going to find that strength. And that's where we're going to find the ability and the reasoning for saying, we've been following some pretty crazy values here for a lot of years, and look at all the damage it's done to these people, and look at the damage that it's done to myself. And we need to change that. My spirit is telling me that. And when we join with others who have done that healing work, I think that that's when we'll get to the root of the iceberg, the bottom of the iceberg. The last thing I wanted to say was, we had a very complex way of life as Dakota people. I talked about the system of governance around extended family. We also had societies that were set up in such a way. And incidentally, too, we've been talking a little bit about policing and the police force. We had policing in our way of life, too. And we had different societies, all different nature of societies, healing societies, hunting societies, quill work societies, and all of them were considered equal. There was no society that was over the other one. And for our men's society, the hunting societies, they had different, they would focus on certain gifts, and then they would form a society around people that they recognized that had similar gifts, and they would have a way of having a society that functioned that way. But for policing, what we would do is that each of these men's society would take turns for a year or for a season of being the police of the society, because they recognized how difficult that role is on your spirit. Because you may have to confront your relative. You may have to do something to your relative that hurts you because they've fallen out of balance. They recognize how difficult that is. And so you should only do it for a year. And then there was a process of restoring you kind of back into and healing from the trauma that you may have experienced. So I think that's another quite ingenious way of thinking about policing, recognizing that it's difficult. And we heard somebody talk about it this morning, that police forces, you know, they develop their own society and they're often apart from, and they go through very difficult experiences. And they're not healed from some of the things that they deal with. So, they say that we had a very complicated and complex way of life, and I just mentioned a few aspects of it, and I could once again go on so much longer about some of those understandings of you know, how to be in relationship with the earth and the healing properties of plants and the stars. We had star knowledge and just profound ways of thinking about how to live in this world. But they say there is one reason why we live that way. That reason was to raise beloved children. To raise children who knew that they were loved and they knew how to love. And I don't just mean kind of the, you know, the nice touchy-feely kind of love. I mean a child, a human being who was a full human being as best they could be, their spirit included. So that their spirit was strong. They knew how to deal with difficulties. They knew how to deal with traumatic experiences. We had a ceremony that we still talk about to this day of dealing with traumatic experiences. It's called Narihichopi. It means calling back the spirit. It recognized that something happened to you when you experienced these traumatic things, that part of you got shut down, and there had to be a process marked by ceremony at the end that brought you back into restoration. It restored that piece of you. And so that's my understanding now of restorative justice, that we should be about the business of restoring our spirits. We've all been damaged by these many crazy, terrible things that happen in this world, all of the isms and all of the painful and difficult and harmful systems that surround us that we've been talking about here. We need a way of restoring our spirit and healing from the trauma that we've experienced. That's all I have for you. So thank you for listening, and I'm looking forward to the questions.
We have a few minutes for questions from the audience, if you'll just step up to one of the two microphones.
Would you tell us more about the seven values? I only caught one in the discussion.
Sure. Humility. And some of you will recognize, too, for those of you who are restorative justice practitioners, sometimes that's what we use as guidelines for our sessions. But humility, integrity, and yeah, I could talk a long time about each one specifically, but I'll just name them now. So humility, integrity, respect, generosity, compassion, courage, and fortitude. Yeah, I wish we had time to talk more about it. And incidentally, too, I used to list values at the beginning of our sessions and write them up on the board and talk about them. I now tend to elicit conversation from the group and talk about, you know, think about a time when you got together, when things went really well. You know, what kind of things were in place? What kind of values were used to ensure a safe setting? And so people will start telling their stories, and out of those stories, we draw out the values, and they become so much more meaningful to people because then they can relate them back to their own stories and their own experiences. And I think it's much more powerful than just simply listing them up at the beginning of a session.
So my partner, Kathleen, and I have wrestled with some of the same questions and that you mentioned. And last night we were having a discussion about hope and how do we move forward in the face of what is so overwhelming, what is so overwhelmingly broken, and will there even be a planet that we can inhabit 50 years from now if what our natural scientists tell us is going to happen. And so I know that you've been learning and studying a lot about trauma, and I was wondering if you could respond to those questions about hope and moving forward and how we might do that as individuals and maybe as groups of people in the midst of the trauma that we have deeply internalized and continue to face.
It's interesting. My Danielle, my oldest daughter, she said a few years ago, she said, why do humans think that if there's no more humans left on the globe, that the Earth will cease to exist? Why do we think that? And I found that a very profound question. You know, she saw that, you know, we've done a lot of terrible things to this earth and we might disappear because of it. But that doesn't mean the earth will cease to exist. It's not going to blow up and be suddenly gone. It'll regenerate itself. That's what it does. It's restoring itself. It tries to do that. I think we're a little too, we're quickly destroying it in order for it to keep up. But it would restore itself eventually. But anyway, I always think about that when I, and that doesn't mean we should not make change, definitely not. But it kind of gives a different perspective on things. As far as hope goes, you know, I kind of say to myself, I'm not going to buy into how hope has been presented to me through the colonization process. And by that, I'm speaking about how oftentimes people will say, well, you know, jewels in heaven. You know, someday everything will be okay. You know, just keep the faith. Keep praying. That kind of thing. I'm not going to buy into that. I need to see action. Hope needs to be a verb for me. And so when I see people like you and your wife and other folks in this room that I've known for a while and the simple fact that you're here and engaging in this conversation, that's action that gives me hope. And so it's tied to more conceptual understanding, but I need to see that kind of action. And I'm hopeful for myself when I take those steps to make change in my life, when I take some action to heal. So that's it's linked to action.
Yes, sir.
My name is Sam Hijazi. I'm originally from Syria. Actually, Tim read my mind, and he asked you the question that I wanted to ask initially about hope. I need a lot of it. But I would like to ask you a different question. And you mentioned something about the Palestinian situation, and I always used a comparison between the Native American and the Palestinian situation. How do you, as a Native American person, came to this conclusion there was a similarity between the two?
probably the most profound thing that happened to me when I went to Palestine in 1998 was witnessing how Palestinians were treated as far as like crossing into different parts of town through border checkpoints and that kind of thing. We went to visit Gaza, and it's just not too far from where I was in Bethlehem. And some of my Palestinian friends had never been to Gaza, even though they have relatives there, been there, you know, for hundreds of years, but they've been separated and they hadn't been able to go visit. So we were able to help them because we were going, they could come with us. But so we as folks that were carrying Canadian and U.S. Passports just walked fairly easily through a checkpoint, and then we had to wait for them because they had to go through a different route behind this big wall. And you could hear voices, these murmur of voices and shouts and that kind of thing. And it took them quite a while to get through, a couple hours to get through. And when they came out, one of the women was physically ill, and they were just, you could just see the distraught in their faces and their countenance. And they just, they said, they treated us like animals, like cattle. And we were so disrespected and dehumanized. And I recognize that that's how my people, my parents and my grandparents were treated not too long ago here in this part of the world. That fear, that forced, you know, that mass incarceration of indigenous people on reservations and reserve, which still goes on to this day. You know, apartheid is alive and well in North America, the reservation system. So making those kinds of connections, seeing how it's, you know, it's playing out in Palestine, and knowing that there's so much, so many similarities with what happened here, it's just, I think that's how I came to that conclusion, was really feeling it. I think that was the, and then figuring out what to do with that feeling, and then being analytical about it, and thinking about it systemically and critically, making the connections.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have a few minutes before the next session begins. If you are a student and need to have your card swipe, you will have to step out into the lobby. Thank you very much.